If you're interested in listening ad-free, go to patreon.com/drnosleep. There you can enjoy my ad-free podcast and never have to listen to ads again. That's patreon.com/drnosleep. Now time for the story.
Dr. Nosleep.
Passing through the cemetery allowed me to get home about 5 minutes faster. The bus stop was just a block over, and the cemetery took up an entire block to itself. So instead of walking down and around it to my house, I'd gotten into the habit of cutting through. Granted, every other time I'd pass through, it was early evening. Tonight, it was a few minutes until midnight. So when I started hearing strange noises from one of the mausoleums, I first attributed it to the late hour and my overworked mind. I had worked a double at the restaurant after one of the other servers called in sick at the last minute. Now I smelled like Tex-Mex, sweat, and grease as I paused and looked toward the distant mausoleum. It was one I had passed many times, but I'd never heard anything like this before. The sound was a low murmur of voices, as if a group of people were praying inside the stone building. It was one of the larger buildings on the grounds, so I figured it was meant for an entire family. It looked like a miniature Roman temple, with white columns flanking the entrance and a peaked roof with the family name carved under it. As with all the other mausoleums and graves I passed, I often wondered who the people inside had been in life. The name was Blackburn. I imagined they were high society members from the early 1900s. I pictured the men in the family wearing suits and fedoras, the women dressing like flappers with high heels and sparkly dresses. I heard something move in the darkness behind me. I glanced in that direction, seeing nothing but gravestones. It was probably a cat or a rabbit. The noise had broken my trance, and I continued on my way, keeping to the path I always took through the graveyard. It would bring me within a few yards of the Blackburn Mausoleum. I didn't think much of it. If people wanted to come and pray for their loved ones in the middle of the night, who was I to judge? But as I approached the structure, I slowed involuntarily, almost not even realizing I was doing it. A relaxing feeling came over me, almost like the feeling you get when listening to good ASMR. The skin on the back of my head and neck buzzed comfortably, and my eyelids drooped halfway down. Something about that murmuring was so nice. I turned toward the Blackburn Mausoleum, my legs moving again. I noticed with a smile that the door was cracked, revealing a shaft of pale light coming from inside. The murmuring grew in intensity, and it sounded like the people talking were saying my name, although it wasn't really my name. The sounds didn't match, but I had the unmistakable feeling that they were talking to me. I reached out and grabbed the door, pushing it open, peering inside. A man and a woman were kneeling on the stone floor of the mausoleum, with their backs to me. I could tell that they were older because they both had wavy white hair cascading down the backs of their necks. The woman's hair was longer than the man's, but even his was long enough to cover his collar. The woman wore a tasteful white gown, and the man wore a suit. I couldn't see their faces, or any part of them not covered by clothing, but they were both rocking back and forth, and I could tell that the pleasant murmuring was coming from them. Some small part of me said that there were too many voices in the murmurs for just two people, but I couldn't worry about such silly things. Not when I knew these two nice old people needed my help. As I stepped into the Blackburn Mausoleum, both of them stopped their rocking, although the murmuring continued.
"I'm here,"
I said, smiling. There was a crunching, creaking sound as the man nodded. He stood up, still with his back to me. He was about 4 inches shorter than me. His thin, bony shoulders made it look as if his suit jacket were hanging on a clothes hanger. He turned toward me, revealing a rotting, skeletal face with a permanent, lipless grin. His eyes were nothing but shriveled orbs held tentatively in place by cracking eyelids. That small part of me that knew something was wrong suddenly screamed out, breaking me out of my trance. My heavy eyelids snapped open as I inhaled a sharp breath. I stepped back, just as the man reached a skeletal hand out and grabbed my wrist. The immensity of the sudden pain made me cry out and look down at my wrist. The dried, nearly gone skin of the man's hand was growing back before my very eyes. Muscles and veins appeared on his fingers in the back of his hand, while my own hand and wrist withered in a matter of moments. Panic-stricken, I grabbed his forearm with my free hand. The transformation apparently hadn't reached so far up his arm, because the brittle bones inside the suit sleeve crunched under my grip. A dry scream erupted from somewhere in the man as he reached for my neck. I felt his scratchy finger scrape across the soft skin of my neck, the touch tightening my skin as he tried to steal my life. I flinched back, yanking on his arm as I went. The bones inside his suit sleeve separated, and I stumbled out of the building. His right hand was still fastened to my arm, but now that it was severed from him, the sickening effect seemed to have mostly reversed itself. Turning to run, I pulled the hand off with some effort, tossing it to the ground. As I ran, I glanced back over my shoulder to see his figure backlit in the mausoleum doorway. I ran all the way back to my house, fear like I'd never known following me the whole way. Although I made it out with my life, I still have the marks to show from that night. The skin of my left wrist is discolored and wrinkled, and my hand is noticeably weaker than it was before. And on my neck, three narrow, discolored marks remind me of where the fingers of his other hand touched me for no more than a moment. Needless to say, I no longer cut through the cemetery on my way home, not at any time of day. When you're young, death seems almost impossible. You laugh in its face because that's the only thing you know how to do. It's the only way the young can deal with the inevitable truth we all must face. The truth that, one day, will be nothing but a memory. This tendency was what brought me and my friends to the old graveyard on the outskirts of our small Vermont town one crisp fall evening. It was boredom mixed with that indefinable urge to prove to each other that we didn't fear death. It was the sure knowledge that we would find nothing but silent gravestones and scattered leaves on the hallowed ground. But I knew my friends well enough to know that we were all looking forward to creeping each other out just a little bit to pass the time. Jason, Samantha, and I got out of the car outside the main entrance to the graveyard. There was an old wooden church there, which was still in use by a dozen or so old-timers who lived outside of town. But as far as I knew, the graveyard was no longer accepting new dead. The old black wrought iron fence surrounding the considerable lot had probably been there for over 100 years. We moved through the archway, joking and giggling like the teenagers we were. Clouds slowly passed the sliver of moon in the sky, providing little light for us to see by. This was in the time before cell phones, so we had no convenient way to light our path. None of us had thought to bring a flashlight. Indeed, it would have spoiled the fun. So we had to wait as our eyes adjusted to the dim surroundings. As we crested a rolling hill among the tilted and fading gravestones, I heard a distant giggle, as if from a child. I turned toward Jason, our resident prankster, and asked,
"How did you do that?"
He smiled but shook his head.
"What? That giggle.
I heard it too,"
Samantha said in a spooky voice.
"I don't think it was Jason. It was probably the protectors of the dead."
I scrunched my face up.
"Protectors of the dead? Is it ghost story time now?"
"You haven't heard the stories about this graveyard?"
Samantha asked, wide-eyed.
"I thought that was the whole reason for coming here."
"You're kidding, right?"
I asked.
"You know what she's talking about, Jason?"
My friend nodded.
"Oh, sure.
You gotta be careful out here. Don't disturb anything. Like this."
Jason moved to the nearest gravestone and kicked it with the flat of his foot. The thing tilted slightly, the ground around its base bulging.
"Don't do that,"
Samantha said.
"I'm serious. They're real. My grandma told me so."
"Just a bunch of old person nonsense,"
Jason said.
"If you believe that stuff, you're..."
A dark shape dotted toward us before disappearing behind a gravestone. I pointed.
"What the hell was that? Just a cat or something?"
Jason said, ever the macho man.
"That'd be the biggest cat I've ever seen,"
I said.
"Maybe we should go."
Without a word, Jason stalked forward toward the gravestone behind which the dark shape had disappeared. He moved fast, looking behind it.
Nothing here.
He smiled and sat on top of the gravestone, crossing his arms, looking smug. With his weight on the old stone, it tilted, the grass at its base bulging, much like the other one had. Only this time, it wasn't just the gravestone that was moving the ground. A hand-shaped smudge of darkness burst from the ground and grabbed Jason by the ankle. Although it looked like a constantly shifting formation of black smoke, it was clearly real enough to touch him. Jason shouted and stood up to run, but the hand held fast.
Help me!
He screamed. Dark, child-sized figures appeared all around us, rushing forward with glowing yellow eyes and hungry mouths with bright white teeth. They converged on Jason, who was now screaming in pain. Some of them grabbed hold of his arms and legs, while others plunged their shimmering dark hands into his chest and his head, as if his skin and bone were no more a barrier than the chilly night air. I moved forward to help my friend, but Samantha grabbed my arm. I looked back at her, and she shook her head, wide, frightened eyes pleading with me. Yanking my arm from her grasp, I moved toward my screaming friend and went to grab one of the strange, childlike creatures. As soon as my fingers touched the smoky skin, a shotgun blast of visions hit me. I experienced the death of every single person buried in that graveyard as if it were my own. I found myself screaming in pain on a Civil War battlefield as a surgeon sawed my leg off just before darkness took me. I was an old woman, alone in my house, when a tremendous pain gripped me by the chest. My breathing suddenly stopped as I fell to the floor, gripped by panic for the final moments of my life. I was shot, stabbed, and trampled by horses. I died on a battlefield somewhere in Europe when poison gas rolled toward the American trench and I couldn't find my gas mask. I took my own life half a dozen times, and I died in my sleep a dozen more. I was riddled with disease and consumed by cancer. And once, as a black man, I was hung from a tree by a mob of white people for some imagined insult. And I could do nothing to stop any of it. Nothing at all. Just as I knew I could do nothing to stop my own eventual demise. The only deaths I did not experience were those of the children buried in the graveyard, because their spirits were otherwise occupied. They were the protectors of the dead. Gasping for air, I found myself on the ground in the graveyard. Samantha was trying to pull me up, to get me away from the furious assault still happening to Jason mere feet away. Scrambling up, I ran away with Samantha, only slowing to vomit along the way. Samantha drove to her grandmother's house, waking the old woman up and telling her what had happened.
Take me there at once,
the woman said, still in her nightgown. I was there for all this, but I was still reliving all those deaths I had experienced, the swirl of emotions inside overwhelming my adolescent mind. When we returned to the graveyard, Samantha and her grandmother found Jason wandering among the gravestones with a blank look on his face. Jason never was the same after that. The doctors couldn't figure out what had happened. And Samantha's grandmother told us not to tell what we'd seen. She said we'd be social outcasts if we told the truth. So we did as she said. Jason eventually came around after many years. He was able to get a job and support himself. But he always had that blank look in his eyes, and he barely said a word to anyone unless he had to. If I experienced what I did from only touching one of those things, I can't imagine what Jason went through. As for me, I still dream about all those deaths I experienced. But for all the fear and terror and dread, I think it's made me a better man. Because I know there's no stopping death. I've seen what it's like. I felt its icy grip on my heart. But a funny thing happened many years after that night. I realized I was no longer afraid of death. I accepted it. I respected it. And it freed me to live the life that very few people get to live. A life of constant gratitude and awe. A life I know will most likely come to an unpleasant end. And that's okay.
I can't do this no more!
The man shouted. I heard him clearly through the closed office door as I sat in the waiting area outside. The woman who answered wasn't loud enough for me to hear her words, She spoke in low, soothing tones.
I can't! You'll finish out your shift, or I will deny your unemployment!
The woman shouted. There was the clatter of a chair, and then the door flew open. A man with flaky skin on his face and arm stormed out, moving past me without a glance. His haunted eyes seemed lost in their own turmoil. He moved down the hall and around the corner, out of my vision. A moment later, a plump and pleasant-looking woman appeared in the office doorway and smiled at me.
Sorry about that, Mr. Harris. I'm afraid our current maintenance worker is having a bit of trouble. Please, come in.
It's no problem,
I said, grabbing the folder with all my personal information in it. I spent the next 2 hours filling out paperwork and letting Mrs. Cooper copy my license and social security card and all the other legally required stuff for employment. By the time we stepped outside, the sun was beyond the western horizon, leaving only dying light to illuminate the sprawling graveyard. Mrs. Cooper radioed the maintenance man I'd seen storming out of the office. She said his name was Barnes. She wanted him to show me around before he left. But after 3 tries to alert him over the radio, she threw her hands up.
Maybe he actually left already, she said.
If you don't mind me asking, what's wrong with him?
Mrs. Cooper flapped a hand.
Oh, he says he's been having nightmares about dead people. He's only been working here for 2 years, but for the last few months, he's been struggling. I'm sure you saw his skin. Well, that's new too. Apparently, his doctor says it's stress-related. I guess some people just aren't cut out for this kind of work.
I nodded, feeling sorry for the guy.
But you've been in this business for a while now, right?
Mrs. Cooper asked.
4 years?
I nodded.
That's right. Good. So if I leave you to look around, you shouldn't have too much trouble getting the lay of the land, right? I have some paperwork I need to do before I call it a day.
I think I'll manage, I said.
Great.
Mrs. Cooper produced the key ring from her pocket and handed it to me.
If you walk that way, you'll see the maintenance building just over that hill. You can get in the truck and drive around if you like.
Sounds good,
I said, taking the keys. We parted ways, Mrs. Cooper going back inside and me heading the way she pointed. As I walked along, I saw a backhoe parked next to a couple of dug-up graves. Dirt was piled haphazardly on another grave. This wasn't the way things were supposed to be done. The dirt was supposed to be put into a truck and moved out of sight until the ceremony was over. But as I got closer, I realized the dates on both the dug-up graves were from years past. I approached warily, looking into the first grave. The casket was open at the bottom of the hole, but there was no body in it. Swallowing, I moved to the next grave and saw the same thing. Telling myself there was some logical explanation, I resumed my journey toward the maintenance building. I saw the building just like she said, but the garage door was open, and there was no truck parked inside. As I got closer, I saw something on the ground in the garage. It looked like a pile of skin flakes mixed with a small amount of blood. Glancing around, I looked for any sign of Barnes. There was no one around. The place was as silent as any graveyard just after dusk, preternaturally silent. I moved through the maintenance building, noting the location of tools and bags of grass seeds and maintenance schedules. There was one empty slot on the tool wall. I didn't know what had been there, but I knew from the empty space it was a tool with a long handle, maybe an axe or a pickaxe. I stared at that empty space for a long time, a bad feeling humming through me. Finally, I headed back to the admin building to tell Mrs. Cooper I was done looking around, at least until I could find the truck. But as I came over the low hill and brought the building into view, I saw the maintenance truck parked in front of the building. Its headlights were on and the driver's door was open. From behind the vehicle, I could see that someone was sitting in the passenger seat. I wondered if it was Barnes, waiting for me to come back so he could show me the grounds. Picking up the pace, I moved up the driver's side and glanced in, freezing as I saw the decomposing corpse sitting in the passenger seat. Its dark eye sockets stared accusingly at me. Then I saw the blood on the steering wheel and the door handle. Without thinking clearly, I ran into the building and straight to Mrs. Cooper's office, coming to an abrupt stop in the doorway. Barnes was standing next to the desk, breathing heavily and holding a bloody pickaxe in his hands. The skin of his arms and face had been rubbed raw. Rivulets of blood streamed from the wounds, dripping here and there. There was blood splashed on the wall, and I could see Mrs. Cooper's feet sticking beyond the edge of the desk. The rest of her was obscured by the furniture. From the blood and the way those feet weren't moving, I had a feeling she was dead. Barnes turned toward me, his eyes fiery. He stalked over to me, pickaxe held before him. I found myself frozen with fear as the man came toward me. My legs would not move. My arms were stuck at my sides. My mind stuttered, failing me at the time when I needed it most. Barnes raised the pickaxe to strike me, and just before he swung it down, the words came out of my mouth, seemingly out of nowhere.
"You can go on home,"
I said in a voice that was impossibly calm.
"I'll take care of the burial."
Barnes froze, pickaxe held aloft, confusion swarming his face.
"You're done," I said. "I've got this. You don't have to do it anymore."
Barnes lowered the tool, the fire in his eyes dying down to glowing embers. He stepped forward and handed me the pickaxe. Then he nodded once and walked past me. I watched him turn the corner and lost him from sight. The police later found him at home, watching television. One of the officers later told me that he looked through the window and saw Barnes. The man had tears streaming down his face, even before he knew the police were there. He just wanted to go away from the dead. And I guess, in the end, he did.